Today on Against the Grain, more than a century ago, the industrial workers of the world, or Wobblies, called for the four-hour workday. Should we be considering something similar now? I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Kathy Weeks about why radicals need to envision a world where work is not central to our existence. She also talks about cutting the work week without a cut in pay and the need for a basic guaranteed income. That's coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Liberating work from its exploitative nature under capitalism has been a central tenet of the radical left. But what about liberating our lives from the centrality of work? Work may be necessary, but should it be at the heart of our vision for the future? And what would be the political consequences of demanding shorter working hours in the here and now? The autonomous Marxist tradition has championed the refusal of work, and today I'm joined by Kathy Weeks, who brings together Marxism and feminism in arguing that we need to rethink the place of work in our imaginings of life after capitalism. She also argues that in the present, we should fight for a significantly shorter work week without a cut in pay and for a guaranteed basic income for all. Kathy Weeks teaches women's studies at Duke University and is the author of a number of books, including The Problem with Work, Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries. That's published by Duke University Press. Kathy, could you begin by describing for us the history of the work ethic under Western capitalism? How has it evolved? Why has it been so central?
Well, I mean, I trace it back in the book to Max Weber's famous study in the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. And he identifies the original kind of formulation of the work ethic as the Protestant work ethic. And he talks about how it creates some of the conditions conducive to early capitalist development. So it promoted really hard work and long hours from one class of people, workers, and frugal savings on the other side. So that made it possible to produce capital in that moment. But over time, I think the work ethic has evolved and changed slightly. I mean, in some ways, it remains the same. In all its forms, the work ethic sort of preaches the value of work as an end in itself, not just a means to other ends. It preaches the importance of hard work as not just an instrumental activity, but a kind of highest calling and ethical duty as what we should organize our lives around, as what we should invest our identity in. And I think that element of the work ethic remains similar across time. The supposed rewards of all of this activity sort of shift. I mean, it's no longer sort of, as it was for Weber, a matter of the anxious Protestant being sort of assured of their being among the elect or the saved. It's not even anymore the industrial version that promised that one could pull oneself or one's family up by their bootstraps and sort of climb the class ladder through this activity. And I think today it's much more about, you know, being able to develop your capacities as an individual. So, I mean, what's promised by all of these activities shifts, but I think that the basic sort of insistence on the on work as an end in itself rather than just an instrumental activity remains the same.
You've just been describing the centrality of the work ethic within capitalism, particularly in the West. But work itself, the process of work itself, seems to be pretty uninterrogated, both within academia in many ways, also for people. They feel frustration at work often, but they see it as an individual problem. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it is that we have such a hard time getting a handle on work in our lives, our relationship to work?
Yeah, I mean, I just find that a really interesting problem. And I have a couple of ways of getting at it, but I think it remains an open question that is, you know, and I think of it in terms of why work is not more politicized than it is now in some ways. I mean, it's strangely depoliticized. And yet, I think work is where most of us experience, you know, direct relationships of domination, you know, between bosses and, you know, employees and among coworkers. You know, work is an incredibly hierarchical structure in most sites. So, I mean, I think it is an interesting question why we don't want to interrogate more the actual everyday experience of work. And again, I think it is in part because we treat work as, we don't really think of it in terms of a system. We think of it in terms of this job or that job, and we measure one job in relationship to another job. But we don't really think about the similarities among jobs or think about work as a system, let alone as a system of sort of domination, you know, that it gives employers power over employees. I mean, that's crucial to how, you know, most of us experience work, and yet we don't think of it as a site of power relations that should be evaluated for their, you know, their justice or lack of justice. And again, I find that an interesting puzzle.
We'll probably speak more about this in the course of the hour, but how do you define work? Are you speaking just of paid labor? Does unpaid labor fit into this? What is work in your definition?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a good question. And generally, when I talk about work, I tend to focus more on the privileged model of wage labor because I think that's how we understand work popularly. But I think what counts as work is constantly being debated. It's certainly something that feminists have long debated, you know, why forms of unwaged work are not counted as work. So I don't want to limit it to waged work, but I do want to highlight that when we talk about work, we usually mean wage labor, and that waged labor becomes the standard for what we count as work. So I slip between a focus on just wage labor and also a more expansive understanding of what work is.
So your book, The Problem with Work, draws on a couple different traditions. It draws on Marxism, draws on feminism, and traditions within them. But the traditional Marxist critique of work has two basic or central elements. There's, on the one hand, the critique of exploitation, the extraction of surplus value. And then, on the other hand, there is a critique about alienation, that work is alienating, that it degrades our skills and makes us separate from our actual work process. So the idea within Marxism is that in a society that would be socialist or communist, the idea would be to free work from its oppressive aspects and make it joyous. You have a different take on how work should be in a, say, more utopian society. What are your problems with the Marxist critique as traditionally conceived?
Well, I mean, I think the problem with both of those versions of the Marxist critique is that they leave the work ethic uninterrogated. That is, work could live up to what the ideology says it will do for us if only work were not a site of exploitation and alienation. So I think its critique of work is incomplete, to put it mildly. So I draw on other traditions also within Marxism that I think try to take aim both at, you know, the system of an organization of production, but also the ideology of productivism. You know, so not just work, but also the ethics and our ideas about work that support and encourage us to invest in work. So one tradition that I'm very interested in is the tradition of autonomous Marxism. And there's a kind of slogan that's central to most iterations of autonomous Marxism, and that's been the refusal of work. And at one level, it's kind of, you know, self-evident. You know, refusing work is, you know, the strike is an example of refusing work. But at another, like, more theoretical level, the refusal of work is really an attempt to try to think much more critically about both the present world of work and, you know, the ethical discourse that helps to sustain it. So the problem from this point of view is not just that work is exploited or that our work, our labor is alienated. It's really that, you know, the critique has to go farther. It has to extend to the ways that work really dominates our existence, the way that work is overvalued. And I think that this one tradition of Marx really wants to sort of Marxism really wants to take the critique much further, beyond just the critique of exploitation and alienation.
And I will ask you more about some of these different contending perspectives, but I just want to ask you, what does refusal of work mean? I would imagine most listeners hearing that phrase would say, but wait a minute, so many people are out of work. Why would we want to refuse work? What does it really mean? Are you talking about a society where no one actually works?
Well, I mean, I don't read the refusal of work as a mandate aimed at individuals. I mean, in a society like ours, I don't think most of us have an opportunity to just walk away from work. We need it. I think of it more as a kind of collective political project and also a theoretical project. So as a theoretical project, it is an attempt to try to think much more critically about work that takes aim at not just the structures of work, but the ethics of work and our evaluation of work, even our overvaluation of work. But also as a political project, I think it's necessarily a cultural effort to try to rethink the place of work in the lives of individuals and collectivities. And one of the traditions of autonomous Marxism that I'm really interested in and that I draw on in the book is the tradition of wages for housework, which developed particularly in the 1970s in Europe and in North America. And in sort of adopting the notion of the refusal of work and applying it to unwaged domestic work, I think they really sort of forced us to clarify what it means to refuse work. Because, you know, it's one thing to refuse factory work and imagine that somebody could walk away from factory work, or collectively members of a union could strike as a way to refuse work. But I think, you know, trying to think about how unwaged domestic workers, women, could just walk away from their responsibilities in the house, I think makes that seem a little too simple. You know, so I think feminists teach us that, you know, the refusal of work is not necessarily walking away, either because you need money or because there's people depending on you, but that it means that we need to really think collectively about creating conditions where individuals are not, you know, tethered so tightly to the existing forms of work, where they're allowed either more time off work or other resources that they could draw on besides just income from work. So I think of it more as a collective political and theoretical project rather than, you know, a prescription for individual action.
And I'll ask you more about the whole feminist dimension of this argument a bit later on. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Kathy Weeks about her book, The Problem with Work, Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries. That's published by Duke University Press. So I want to just stay a little longer with the Marxist tradition, and you were saying that you're drawing from the autonomous Marxist tradition, particularly, which a lot of these ideas swirled around in Italy in the 1970s, intersected with feminism. But sticking with the more traditional Marxist critique, you mentioned a moment ago the notion of productivism, which I wonder if you could explain. It's something that you locate within Marxism, but also within other ideologies and radically different political outlooks. What is productivism?
Well, I mean, I link it to the ideology of the work ethic, essentially. It is that, you know, this celebration of productive activity as sort of the essence of what it means to be human, and, you know, and what we should be doing when we come together as collectivities. So I really think of the ideology of productivism as an offshoot in some ways, or another iteration of work ethic ideology. And again, it's an ideology that elevates work over other kinds of practices and values.
Within Marxism, you locate two traditions where the lack of interrogation of work as you see it leads to what you deem insufficient solutions or visions for a new utopian society. One of them is socialist modernism, and the other is socialist humanism. I wonder if you could explain both of those, what they are first, and then why you have problems with the solutions that are on offer within those two traditions.
Well, I think what I call socialist modernism is really associated with a certain kind of orthodox reading of Marx that really focuses on the problem primarily of exploitation, that it's really a problem of, in some ways, you know, it's almost a distributive problem. You know, it's a problem of distributing property, of distributing surplus value and control over property and surplus value. And so the critique, I think, is in some ways quite limited. You know, I mean, that the solution is then to end the private ownership of property and institute some kind of, you know, collective organization of work. But the critique doesn't necessarily extend to the work process itself, you know, what we do at work all day, or not necessarily to the way that we value work over other kinds of activities or practices. Socialist humanism, then, I associate with much more the critique of alienation, you know, so it extends the critique to, you know, the experience of work and the problem of not having one sort of, you know, a capacity to labor to be adequately realized in some ways. But, I mean, potentially the solution there is to have, you know, better work. You know, if the solution for the first one is to, you know, make sure that everyone has work and it's easy, you know, equitably distributed, in the second, socialist humanism, it's really that we need to make work better. And while I agree that in a society like ours where work is a requirement, it's the way that most of us have access to any kind of income, I think we do need to lobby for more work. As long as that's the way that people have access to income, we have to fight for more work. And I think that work should be improved. The problem is that the call for better work can so be easily co-opted. I mean, essentially, that employers now, like, you know, Google or other kinds of employers, can say that, oh, yes, we will make your experience at work much more, you know, will humanize work, that you will be able to meet your goals and develop your capacities as an individual. Well, that's also an excuse for intensifying the experience of work. So we'll give you better work and we'll also give you long hours. And so I really want to insist on the importance of less work as an important goal and also lesser work, right? That is a kind of, you know, demoting it in our hierarchy of values. I think work is overvalued, and I think that we do too much of it. And I think those should be important goals, too, is really reducing work and making time for other aspects of our life and making room in our hierarchy of values for the importance of other kinds of pastimes and other kinds of practices.
Well, within Marxism, though, work, I think, isn't simply just about the productivist aspect that you mentioned, but you could also argue that work has been seen to be the kind of center of people's social and collective power, that having work is important because it gives you a collective strength being brought together in work, which you don't have under capitalism as an individual, and that also within work there may be even sort of creative or utopian potentialities. How do you respond to that argument in favor of the centrality of work?
Well, I would respond by saying I haven't seen much evidence of people's being empowered through work as workers in, you know, their opposition to the present organization of work. I support it entirely, but I think that we need to try to think about additional ways to politicize work and to fight for change. And so one of the reasons that I'm interested in this kind of politics of work that's really a critique of the overvaluation of work and also the, you know, the way that work dominates our lives and also our imaginations of sociality is I think that we can construct a more powerful coalition of activists. I mean, in some ways, rather than focusing on only the employed or employed in certain kinds of industries or employed who have access to unions, this is a way to think about some of our common problems with work. I mean, I think that the people who are unemployed, underemployed, and also overworked all have an investment in this critique of work. And I really want to think about constructing a politics of and against work that can draw in more people, that can speak to a range of people's problems with work. I don't think it's the province of a specific class formation, as it's been, you know, understood at this point. I think that there's a possibility to provoke other kinds of activism across other, you know, these, some of these traditional divides of union, non-union, employed, unemployed, waged workers, unwaged workers.
Kathy Weeks is my guest. We'll return with her after this music break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by the author of The Problem with Work. Her name is Kathy Weeks, and she teaches women's studies at Duke University. She's also the author of Constituting Feminist Subjects. And we are talking today about the issues around a politics that puts work at its center. She's arguing for more utopian possibilities. So earlier in the program, you spoke about the Italian feminist, autonomous Marxist traditions, which were connected up in the 1970s efforts for wages for housework. And I want to ask you more about your critique of feminism as it relates to work, but I wonder if you could tell us more about what the Wages for Housework campaign actually was, Wages from Whom, for example, as a way of looking at this dimension of your argument?
Well, the particular texts that I'm interested in were produced primarily in the 1970s. And it was centered, the text and then the effort, and it was both, you know, a practical project, it was a political project, but it also was a theoretical project. And what they demanded was wages for housework, not wages for housewives, but wages for housework. And what I find so inspiring about it is not the content of the demand. I don't think it's a good idea to demand wages for housework. But I really learned a lot from reading these texts about, first of all, what a demand was and what it could do. Because in some ways, I think they really wanted what they demanded, you know, wages paid for housework. But in other ways, I think they used the demand as a kind of educational tool. It was really sort of meant to force people to think about the place of domestic work or housework in relationship to the wage labor economy. I mean, forcing us to recognize that it, you know, it too is work. It's the reproductive work that makes productive work possible in some ways, and yet it's not paid a wage. So the, it was an attempt to try to get people to recognize this as, you know, socially necessary labor that makes, you know, so-called productive labor possible. So insisting that it was something that deserved a wage was a way to kind of make that point. You know, if work was a way to get social recognition and social rights and income, well, then, you know, then housewives, housework deserves this as well. But at the same time, when they tried to say it was work, they didn't mean that it was something to celebrate. And this is, you know, their incorporation of the refusal of work perspective. They really wanted to, by insisting that housework was work, they wanted to insist that it was socially necessary labor, but that it wasn't something that we should romanticize, you know, or glorify. You know, as work, it too was something that we should struggle against becoming the whole of life. So on the one hand, they wanted to sort of gain recognition for this work that isn't necessarily recognized at work as work, particularly in the 1970s, but also to sort of demote it and deromanticize it and demystify it as well, something that they also wanted to insist should have limits on it. So they wanted to sort of think critically about both wage work and the institution of the family understood as part of the economy. You know, an institution that organizes another sector of work, and particularly one that through its status as a private site coded it as, you know, not quite work and really something that women were going to be more responsible for men. So I find that really interesting because in some ways the problem with certain iterations of feminism in regard to work is that it's been reduced to either the struggle for more work for women, you know, for women to gain access to all kinds of jobs, which is an important goal, or to a kind of a version of the call for better work by insisting that, you know, men too should, you know, be responsible for unwaged domestic work too, and that work should be supported and shared. And I think that's an important goal too. But again, I also think that this kind of work, this kind of domestic work, should also, you know, sort of be interrogated for the ethics that bind us to it. I mean, as work, I think it too should be subject to critique.
Does feminism have its own, and of course I'm generalizing when I say feminism, it's obviously a broad category, but outside of the Marxist feminist tradition that you've just been talking about around wages for housework, does the feminist tradition have its own politics related to an embrace of the work ethic?
Well, I mean, there's so many different sort of strands of feminism, it'd be hard to generalize, but I think one dominant trend is, you know, the longstanding effort to integrate women as equals into the wage labor economy. And I still think that's probably the most sort of legible, visible version of feminism that's often even identified, you know, equated with feminism in its entirety. And again, I find that, you know, both important, you know, because being excluded from waged work or marginalized in relationship to it in a society where most of us depend on it is a problem. But on the other hand, I find that inadequate that it, you know, it doesn't then interrogate, you know, why waged work is valued more than other forms of work and, you know, what the actual experience of work is and why, you know, why wage work would be valued over other kinds of activities or practices. You know, the other struggle that's associated with contemporary feminism, and again, I think it's a very important one, is to, again, gain recognition for all the kinds of, you know, domestic activities and caring practices that do not merit a wage and that have not necessarily been visible enough as work, and I do. I think that's important too. But again, while I want to sort of, along with wages for housework, try to insist on all of these unwaged practices as work, like them, I also don't want to sort of then, you know, fall into the trap of celebrating it and thus sort of extending the reach of the work ethic so that now it covers not only the dignity of waged work, but also the dignity and the value of unwaged domestic work. Again, I want to insist that it's work, but I don't want to glorify it because it's work.
Is there also the danger within feminism that when work is subject to critique, it often gets contrasted to work time and family time, that, you know, we need to allow people to have time with their families, and so the whole notion of the time when one isn't at paid labor, that it is seen through that familial lens?
Yes, and again, that's another reason why I find wages for housework so refreshing, because they insisted that a family was just, you know, within, not against or outside the system of work. You know, that it is part of the general economy. It's where work is organized and where work takes place. It just happens to be mostly unwaged work. So the idea that, you know, family would be the refuge from work, and that family is something that we should be balancing with work, is something that I think that they critique quite well, because family is another site of work. So I think they want to sort of include the critique of family in the larger critique of work and try to think different, you know, in different ways about what we want outside of work, and that we might want time for families and other kinds of relationships of care and sociality. But, you know, family, it's not limited to this institution of the family.
Well, let's talk about what we want outside of work. You just said that although you have found the Wages for Housework campaign of the 70s to be very stimulating in your thinking, that ultimately wages for housework is not enough. So in terms of what you're proposing as an alternative to our work-centered lives, you mentioned two things, two reforms of sorts. One is a basic income guarantee, and the other is a 30-hour work week without a cut in pay. Let me ask you first about the basic income guarantee. How would that work? Why do you support it?
Well, basic, I mean, there are many different sort of proposals out there for what, how we imagine a basic income. As I imagine it, it would be an income that would be paid unconditionally to individuals. And it's designed to sort of establish a kind of minimal floor below which income would not fall. If it, you know, I mean, again, there's different versions of this. If this income is so small that people would be forced into work, all it does is sort of subsidize low-wage labor in some ways. But if it's an income that someone could possibly live on, independent of work, it would enable people to maybe not be completely independent of the wage system, but less dependent on its sort of present terms and conditions. So I think it might give, you know, workers some bargaining power to demand, you know, better work in some ways. It provides support for all of the kinds of unwaged work, and, you know, and for workers that are precarious at this point. And I think it also then, you know, provides some relief for those who are forced into family relationships in order to be part of another income pooling unit. So I think a basic income would provide, again, it wouldn't probably enable most people to be free of the wage system, but I think it would allow people some measure of relief to be not tethered to it so tightly.
And the other part of the demands that you focus on in the book is a 30-hour work week without a cut in pay. What is the logic for that?
Well, I mean, you know, I think this is the way that different proponents of wages for housework would put it. It's a way to sort of reappropriate social wealth in the form of time. You know, with all of the increases in productivity that we've managed to see over the years, we haven't really been able to shorten the hours of work since the post-World War II period. So I think this would be another way to allow people to imagine and experience time away from work, whether that be engaged with family responsibilities or other venues of life that they want to explore. But, you know, I should say that I'm really interested in these two demands as reforms, and I think real reforms that would improve, you know, people's lives. But I'm also interested in both of these demands because of the way they function as critical perspectives on the relationship between work and the rest of life, and as kind of provocations to the political imagination to think about life outside of work and what we might want if we had more time outside of work. And I think that's what's really interesting about these, is the way that they sort of force us to sort of think about work and its place in our life, and you know what we would want if we were not so if our lives were not so relentlessly subordinated to work in some ways. So I'm interested in them as reforms that I think could help, but also as sort of critical tools that will force kind of conversations and force us to think critically about how we now experience work in relationship to the rest of life.
The kind of argument that you've been making and you make in your book is one about how shortening the work week with no loss in pay would allow us sort of an opening to see other possibilities and transform our lives in the present as well. But don't you think a powerful argument could be made for an ecological critique, which is that by shortening the workday, one would mitigate to some degree overproduction and resource depletion?
I do. I mean, I think that is an interesting way to expand it. And there's all kinds of ways that you could think about it. And so, I mean, I've been thinking about it recently in terms of sort of expanding the feminist insight that there are all these forms of unwaged work that should count as socially necessary labor and should be recognized and valued as such, and kind of flipping that on its head and using that as a standard against which to measure all of these forms of wage labor that we're engaged in that could arguably, you know, deemed socially unnecessary labor that produces things that we don't necessarily need or necessarily want, to critique some of the ways that we produce now.
In William Morris's term, useful work versus useless toil.
Yeah, I mean, the only concern I have is that I'm reticent, particularly when we talk about a politics of work in this country, where usually, you know, the solution is to provide more work, you know, to try make work programs to produce more jobs, even if we don't really need them, because we have no other way of distributing income. That the rationale for shorter hours and a basic income, the rationale for reducing work and demoted in our hierarchy of values is so that we would, you know, produce less in some ways. I'm worried about the kind of asceticism, the kind of austerity in some ways that might be read into that iteration of the demand. So instead of, you know, the idea that, you know, we need to produce less, I mean, I think it's important to imagine that, you know, we'd have time off work to do other kinds of things, and including engage in, you know, environmental acts of care and politics.
I think that's an important point. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Kathy Weeks. She's the author of The Problem with Work, Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries, published by Duke University Press. She teaches at Duke in Women's Studies. You conclude the book by an exploration of, or a defense of, utopian demands. And I wanted to ask you, though, as someone who's quite, I guess, unfashionably attracted to utopian demands, are these demands, at least the basic income guarantee, the idea of a 30-hour work week without a cut in pay, are they really that utopian? And I ask that because there are aspects of both of these demands that one can see absolutely embraced by the mainstream and by the right. In France, in 2000, the 35-hour work week was adopted, obviously not without a cut in pay. And the idea of a basic income guarantee is something that one can see on the right. Libertarians having dusted off Milton Friedman's version of a basic income guarantee, which they would seek to replace the welfare state with. Now, presumably, in that case, the idea would be to not have a particularly high basic income in the hands of the right. Couldn't both of these two demands, that is, for a basic income guarantee and a 30-hour work week, be absorbed into society as it is? I mean, would these really be that radical? And why is it that they're appealing to the right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. And there's a lot of ways to get at this. But I think, you know, one thing to say is that I don't think that the achievement of a guaranteed basic income or a 30-hour work week without a decrease in pay would be utopia. You know, I mean, I think in some ways that these demands are steps, they're tactics, they're strategies rather than terminal points or ends. I think we would be better off. And I think that if these were won, we would have more time and more kinds of conceptual resources to demand and think about further changes. So I don't really think of them themselves as a kind of endpoint. I think of them as useful steps in a larger kind of struggle. So that's one thing to say. And the other is that, yes, there is a risk of them being co-opted. There is a risk that we would win 30 hours with a decrease in pay or a guaranteed basic income that would be set at such a low level that it would essentially, you know, subsidize employers like Walmart that don't pay living wages. Yes, and I think any kind of demand is a risk. But in trying to think about utopian demands, I was really trying to think about, you know, putting together things that don't fit well together, utopia and demand. I mean, a demand for it to work has to be somewhat legible. You know, it has to be something that's possible, and it's something that we might even want to win. But, I mean, I do think of them as still quite utopian. I still think most of these demands would at least raise eyebrows among most people. I mean, I do think of them as something that would be certainly not impossible, but they would be difficult to win on our own terms, on the terms that we want them. So, I mean, I think the other thing I would say is, you know, politics is, I don't think it's useful to try to imagine a political demand that would be pure, right, that could never be co-opted. Demands are risks. And I think politics is about risk, and it is about struggle. So, I mean, I don't think of these demands as either recipes for utopia or as unrisky. I do think that they're worth fighting for, though, and I do think that they would represent important reforms that could improve people's lives and also give people opportunities and resources to imagine alternatives. And on the basis of that imagination of alternatives, fight for further reforms and imagine further demands.
Well, let's talk more about those alternatives within the realm of utopian possibilities. You talk about a post-work society, and I wonder if you could tell us why you think of it that way and not within the framework of traditional notions like, say, socialism.
Well, you know, I mean, and I think this might be one of the frustrating things about the book is I'm not going to give a recipe of what I imagine a post-work society to be. I mean, I think, you know, the future is something that we have to invent. It's not something that you can follow some kind of, you know, someone's blueprint. I just don't think that's how social change happens. So I think, you know, part of what I'm trying to do is kind of put some roadblocks in the way of a too simple imagination of what an alternative relationship to work might entail. Because I really want to put as much pressure on the critique of work and on our imagination of something that would be really different. So I tend to, you know, be kind of critical of some other ways of imagining non-work, both because I think our failure to imagine, you know, a post-work society, I think is an interesting symptom of the power of the work ethic. so that it becomes very difficult to imagine, you know, what we would do outside of work. So that, you know, some people imagine, you know, just complete idleness. You know, well, what would I do if I didn't go to work? You know, if work has been identified with activity itself, you know, so that work becomes sort of the paradigm or the essence of what it means to be active, well, then we imagine non-work as just, you know, idleness. And I think that speaks to the power of work over our imagination. You know, the other imagination is, well, we'd have time to be industrious and creative outside of work. Well, sometimes those descriptions make it sound like we would be engaged in the same kind of, you know, single-minded, disciplined, you know, worthy, outcome-producing activity that's still the essence of work. So part of what I try to do is put much more pressure on these imaginations of what we would do outside of work, and in the name of which we would fight for shorter hours or a guaranteed basic income, rather than try to imagine, you know, what a post-work society would be. I think in some ways we don't have a very good way of imagining an alternative to a society that revolves around work in the way that ours does. I think that's both interesting and something that I want to sort of push people to try to, you know, work through, to try to get to the other side and imagine, you know, for ourselves and, you know, what we would do with more work, non-work time.
Even if one is sort of skeptical, as you are, of drawing up blueprints, whatever the phrase is, of coming up with recipes for the cookbooks of the future, mm-hmm. It sounds like the term post-work, though, is still kind of a provocation in the sense that in any society of the future, there's going to be some work involved, right? I mean, obviously, vegetables have to be grown, people need food, housing needs to get constructed. So in a sense, what you're talking about is something radically different, but not so radically different that it cuts off from every moment of history up until that point.
No, right. And I think that is right. And of course, when I think about, you know, post-work, I think about post-work as we know it now. and trying to imagine other ways of organizing and valuing the kind of productive activity that will exist in some utopian future as well. So I kind of use the term post-work as just sort of a placeholder in some ways, you know, that it would be an after to work, but we don't know what that would look like yet.
I guess I would like to end then by asking you how optimistic you are that some of these demands, the demands that you talked about earlier, might be championed and taken up by radicals and others. Obviously, the United States is paramount in terms of the number of hours that people work. Japan is another place. Do you see that these sorts of ideas are getting traction here or perhaps in Europe where some of these ideas might be better known?
Oh, absolutely. And certainly the demand for a guaranteed basic income is something that you can find in a lot of countries around the world. So, I mean, it's not, there's a lot of traction around these ideas, and I'm very optimistic even in the United States. I mean, in some ways, I think, you know, the most recent crisis, and, you know, there will be others, but the most recent one, I think, has revealed quite clearly, you know, to those who were reticent to believe it, that work just isn't working anymore. I mean, work is supposed to do two things for us. It's supposed to, you know, produce profit, and I think it's still working very well to do that. But, you know, the other side was that it was supposed to also, you know, produce income and a way to distribute it among the population. And it is so clearly not working as a way to distribute income or forms of social belonging. There's just too many, it's an incomplete and precarious system of income distribution at best. And I think that even the current unemployment and underemployment level really suggests that it's just not really working. Not only are there all kinds of forms of socially necessary labor that's not covered by the wage system, it's just not able to function anymore as an adequate, even remotely adequate system of income allocation. I think this is just becoming more and more clear. Work is just not working anymore. And I think at this point, more people are going to realize we have to have a different way of allocating income.
Kathy Weeks, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Kathy Weeks. She is professor of women's studies at Duke University, author of Constituting Feminist Subjects, and the book we've been discussing in this hour, The Problem with Work: Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.F. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.